It's that time of year again. My schedule is packed with bracket-busting, three-point shooting, nonstop basketball action. I don't want to miss a second of it, and I find myself staying up late to catch all the action. I can't be dragging the next morning. That's why I go for a 5-hour energy shot. They're perfect for my days packed with back-to-back games or when my favorite team is playing late. With over 15 flavors to choose from, like watermelon, tropical burst, blue raspberry, peach mango, and more, there's a flavor for everyone. On their website, you have the option to build your own 12-pack or 24-pack and have it delivered right to your door. And if you're out and about, you can always pick up a 5-hour energy shot at your local grocery or convenience store. They're everywhere. 5-hour energy keeps me going during the broadcast and the next morning when I need to get myself up and to work. Visit 5hourenergy.com for great deals and to stock up before the next tip-off.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Good morning, folks. Hope you're having a great Thursday morning. We're going to jump right into this because one of our guests is a conflict, and we do want to accommodate him because it is a pressing issue out there, and I'd love to find out more and his thoughts on this issue. Colonel Jeff McCausland joins us, CBS military analyst. Colonel, welcome to the show.
Hey, Neil, it's always a pleasure.
Thank you, sir, so much, appreciate you accommodating us this morning. A lot of folks are concerned about what's happening here, especially relative to some information that came out after these missions started with strikes on the Houthis in Yemen. With a backdrop of talking about limited weapons and really putting a strain on our inventory of arsenal pieces, your thoughts?
Well, it's a possibility. I think what we need to understand, which has been overlooked, is the United States Navy has been involved in the longest period of sustained combat operations in the Red Sea and the Persian Gulf since this began several years ago than at any time since the Second World War. The Houthis have attacked about 175 or so commercial vessels. They've attacked U.S. Navy vessels about 150 times. In the last couple of days, they made sustained attacks against the USS Harry Truman, an aircraft carrier. There's no damage. It was able to protect itself. But this is all part and parcel of that bigger demand that's been placed on our industrial base. As you look around the world, the United States is doing that. At the same time, obviously, that's connected to the war in the Gaza Strip. And we just recently, Secretary of State signed off on a very large, several billion dollar additional military aid package to Israel, who has been expending large amounts of ordnance for the last 18 months or so in the war against Hamas. And then, of course, we've had the three-year war with going on in Ukraine between Ukraine and Russia. The United States has spent about $119 billion, more or less, most of that in military aid to Ukraine. One thing I think people miss is about 60 cents of every dollar of all the aid we've given to Ukraine never leaves the United States because it goes to defense contractors here for the production of military weaponry. And so over the last few years, there's been some expansion of the U.S. defense industrial base to meet those particular requirements. At the same time, of course, there's been a drawdown in U.S. wartime stock. So this has become an increasing concern in the Pentagon. Can our rate of expansion, frankly, meet the demand that's ongoing in all these locations? Or are we getting to a point where the drawdown on our own wartime stocks might put us in a precarious position?
So the goal here is to continue this until they stop their attacks. You're the expert. I'm not. But my sense and just what I'm reading, the moment you articulate that that's your goal, it's on. I doubt they stop. Your thoughts?
Well, I think it's problematical at best, but it's important, I think, to make a clear differentiation. Whereas the Biden administration, for a host of reasons we can discuss, did what I would describe as retaliatory strikes. In other words, the Houthis would shoot at a vessel, and then we would do a bombing raid, perhaps, against the Houthis, along with some of our allies, the British, for example, were actually involved. What the Trump administration has now described is an air campaign, that we're going to sustain this over several weeks, if not longer, until, as you suggest, the old bait quit. Now, that being said, that's going to be a difficult proposition. The Saudis and the Emiratis fought a war with the Houthis a few years ago that lasted about 8 years, largely dependent on air power, and were unable to, in my mind, really defeat the Houthis in full terms. So this question is, can you do that when an awful lot of their ordnance is stored or even produced in factories that are deeply embedded underground? The other thing I think it's important to point out is, of course, in responding to this, the United States has pointed a finger directly at Iran and saying it holds Iran, in many ways, responsible for these attacks because the Iranians have been a large provider, not solely, but a large provider of military weaponry and support to the Houthis, as well as there have been reports of Iranian vessels operating in the Red Sea, providing them intelligence. So might this now expand not only to strikes against the Houthis, but strikes against Iranian vessels at sea that might be bringing in weaponry, or a strike against Iran makes this, again, increasingly problematical.
But having said all of that, and having said what I said, I still struggle and am mystified that what is the appropriate response? I mean, these folks just remind me very similarly of how difficult it has been for the Israelis to deal with Hezbollah as well as Hamas. And it seems as though they're working the same out of the same chapter, out of the same book.
Yeah, I think what it calls for is, frankly, a multifaceted strategy. Military power is certainly a critical aspect of any strategy in this regard. But you need to also, I think, integrate that with your diplomatic power and with your aspects of your alliance power. So what we need to do is, frankly, hold this up more and more, I would argue, to international scrutiny and not make this a bilateral problem between the United States and Yemen. This is an international problem because of the nature of the attacks against international shipping, which are driving up costs all around the world. Frankly, the country that's in many ways suffering the most from this is Egypt. Why? Because we've seen a dramatic reduction in transit through the Suez Canal, and the Egyptian government is very, very dependent on revenue from that particular canal. So trying to do that and galvanize our allies in the region and around the world that are affected, that we need to come together to put pressure on the Houthis and on Iran to stop this, seems to me the appropriate strategy. That being said, at the moment at least, it doesn't appear to me that the Trump administration is terribly interested in working closely with our allies. That just seems to be the general direction of policy that we are now trying to affect. So I think informationally and diplomatically, that's the way to go. And then the other part of that, of course, is this is tied to the ongoing war in the Gaza Strip. If we can figure out some way to bring that to a resolution or move it to a ceasefire, we've seen the Houthis halt those particular attacks when, in fact, we were in periods of ceasefire as we were until a few days ago.
Well, let's pivot to that for a moment. It doesn't look like it's going down a path that's very promising at the present time, right?
No, it doesn't at all. In fact, things have gotten worse overnight. The Israelis recommenced combat operations the last several days. They've done extensive airstrikes all across the Gaza Strip. Reports I've seen suggest well over 400 Palestinians have been killed. And people might dismiss this, but a substantial number of those 400 people that were killed and perhaps 600 or 800 more injured were women and children. That's just a function of two things. A, demography. It's a very large population in a very densely populated area, number one. And number two is the nature of these particular airstrikes, which have been very large, using large-scale ordnance. there's going to be collateral damage, and you're going to have civilians, in this case, a lot of women and children, sadly, are going to be involved. The Israelis have also moved in on the ground. We occupy what's called the Nezarim Corridor, which is a strip of land that basically cuts the Gaza Strip in half, north-south. And this is to prevent Palestinians who have fled from the north to the south from returning to the north, to the area around Gaza City in particular. And then finally, of course, we've seen escalation in the last 24 hours. I've seen Hamas actually respond by firing a couple of missiles at Israeli territory. So there seems to be this now increasing escalation on both sides as the Israelis insist their primary objective remains the same, which is the destruction of Hamas politically and militarily. And as a consequence, Hamas less willing, perhaps, to negotiate an extension of this phase one of the ceasefire, which hopefully would have resulted in the release of further hostages by Hamas.
What is Dax, are you?
Tracking all our cars on Carvana Value Tracker on all our devices? Yes, Kristen, yes I am.
Well, I've been looking for my phone for...
In Dax's domain, we see all. So we always know what our cars are worth.
All of them?
All of them. Value surge, trucks up 3.9%.
That's a great offer.
I know. Sell?
Sell.
Track your car's value with Carvana Value Tracker today.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. Indeed's sponsored jobs help you stand out and hire fast. With sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. And it makes a huge difference. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Plus, with Indeed sponsored jobs, there are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts, and you only pay for results. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/listen. Just go to Indeed.com/listen right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/listen. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Where'd you get those shoes? Easy. They're from DSW. Because DSW has the exact right shoes for whatever you're into right now. You know, like the sneakers that make office hours feel like happy hour. The boots that turn grocery aisles into runways. And all the styles that show off the many sides of you. From daydreamer to multitasker and everything in between. Because you do it all in really great shoes. Find a shoe for every you at your DSW store or DSW.com.
Are you surprised? I'm not. I mean, you know, they made a mockery of the transfer of prisoners. I mean, they were kind of rubbing it in the face of not only Israel, the United States, and all others on that side of the equation to the extent to try and create this image that they're still bigger than what everyone believed them to be.
In some degree, I'm not. You are exactly right that they did that. They did that for their own reasons, I think, to try to, you know, bolster domestic support in the area and support around the region, obviously, which is an awful thing to do with people who have been imprisoned like that. But on the other hand, I think we also need to acknowledge, and both these things can be correct at the same time, Mr. Netanyahu is very interested in many ways in this continuing, because the longer it continues, the longer he will likely stay in office as the prime minister and hold off those who want to push him out of office, which might result in him actually appearing for several court cases that he is under indictment for. For example, the recommencement of hostilities resulted in very extreme, small, conservative Israeli party headed by a guy named Benjamin Kavir, who had left the coalition, putting it in a precarious position because of the ceasefire, has now returned to the cabinet, bolstering Mr. Netanyahu's positions in the Knesset. And there have been widespread demonstrations across Israel by Israelis in the last 24 hours. Many Israelis concerned that Mr. Netanyahu now is increasingly putting the remaining hostages at risk because of his unwillingness to make any kind of concessions.
At war, I guess it's not unusual that you play into each other's hands like this.
It is, and not at all. And everybody has got their own agenda. Everybody's got their own red lines. You have to keep this in mind. One thing that I thought about on this conflict, which made it particularly intractable, is their ultimate objectives of both sides just are totally irreconcilable. On the Israeli side, as I said a moment ago, and they have insisted on this, their goal is to destroy Hamas politically and militarily. Candidly, Newell, between you and I, I've always been skeptical of their ability to do that. How do you destroy an ideology? And somebody may come back. They may not call themselves Hamas. They may call themselves Islamic Jihad 2.0 or whatever they might call themselves. But trying to destroy an ideology is a pretty, pretty difficult thing to do. And as a consequence, and their second objective, of course, is the release of the hostages. If that's your goal, then who you're negotiating with, frankly, is going to be unlikely to negotiate because your objective is to kill me, okay? On the Hamas side, what is their objective? Their objective is to survive. That is their full-fledged objective. Well, those two, at the ultimate end, are irreconcilable. And phase two, which never has really gotten off the ground of these negotiations, called for two things. One, that the Israelis would pull all of their forces out of the Gaza Strip in return for all of the hostages. Well, again, that's the last bargaining chip that Hamas would have in this ultimate game of both sides trying to achieve their final objectives.
Yeah. If you don't mind, can we pivot to Ukraine for just a moment? And I'm just kind of curious. The readouts that came as a result of the meeting with Vladimir Putin and President Trump seemed to be, to me, to be markedly different in a wide chasm between the two. And as days have passed since then, it seems as though there was probably more disagreement than there was agreement. Would that be a fair characterization?
I think with respect to Ukraine, that's true. But actually, I would disagree with you because it seemed to me a substantial portion of the conversation and what Mr. Trump or the White House talked about in the official statement that was released were all about how important it was to improve relations between the United States and Russia. I mean, one of the agreements they came up with was we're now going to have a hockey game between American professional hockey players and Russian professional hockey players. I'm not quite sure what that has to do with Ukraine, but that's one thing that came out of this two-hour conversation, and I think reminds us that in these particular negotiations, that while the objectives of the United States and the objectives of Ukraine overlap, they are hardly coincident. And it's very clear, I think, that the Trump administration really sees enormous advantage longer term to improving relations between the United States and Russia, and that was a substantial part of the conversation. Not only hockey games, but also there was an awful lot of talk of increased economic cooperation, exploring for rare minerals, oil and natural gas leases. All of that was part and parcel of those conversations. So that's an objective for the United States, clearly not an objective for the Ukrainians. But in terms of the other things, you're right. I mean, the only thing with respect to Ukraine that came out of this was this acceptance of a ceasefire in terms of attacking energy infrastructure. And there's even disagreement there. In the aftermath, the Trump administration people are saying we agreed to cease attacks against energy and infrastructure. The Russians, believe it or not, are saying, no, it was energy infrastructure only. And we've seen no evidence of those being ceased so far. And now we have technical experts, either en route to or in Saudi Arabia, U.S., Ukrainian, and Russian, to negotiate exactly what that means, what targets we're talking about, when this would start, how it would be enforced, et cetera. But also no word, will that be a trilateral negotiation of three sides, U.S., Ukraine, and Russia, or will it be a bilat, solely the United States and Russia in the room and the Ukrainians somewhere else? Or will the United States actually mediate a negotiation between Ukraine and Russia as the two protagonists? And how you organize this, it's very, very important on how you move on in the future.
Mm-hmm. Are you? I'm curious why we've not heard much about a discussion relative to Russian assets that are held by the EU as well as by the United States, a significant sum of money in the hundreds of billions of dollars. why that hasn't been part of the conversation at this point in time as it relates to rebuild or whatever, as to, you know, that Russia is going to have to walk from that money.
Yeah, but I think we need to be fair and say that we know of. I mean, it was a two-hour conversation, and the only thing the White House has formally released was a three-paragraph summary. So that might have been part of the conversation. It just made it to the summary.
But, you know, Trump talks about everything publicly. He hasn't really mentioned that at all.
No, he hasn't mentioned it at all, which to me suggests that he's not holding that stick over their head. You know, he's talked about increased sanctions, but against the Russians, never really fleshed out what that means. It always seemed to me that was something the United States, frankly, and the Europeans, because a large portion, if not the majority, of those frozen assets actually are in Europe, not in the United States.
Yeah.
The total number, about $300 billion in frozen assets. We have agreed, we, the United States and the European allies, back during the Biden administration, as interest off those investments would go to providing military assistance to Ukraine. So that much has already been provided. It would seem to me, if we really wanted to put pressure on the Russians, we would just say, if you don't negotiate a settlement, we're going to just give that $300 billion to the Ukrainians in recompense for the fact that, A, you are the aggressor, you have killed thousands of innocent Ukrainians, civilians in particular, and you have destroyed billions of dollars of Ukrainian infrastructure. So this is basically going to be recompense for the aggression you have committed. So far, at least, I think, because of the hope for some type of negotiation, that has not been affected.
Yeah, I mean, $300 billion worth of weaponry, which would help the defense industry in our country and in Europe and others, could go a long way for the Ukrainians, right?
Oh, absolutely correct. No doubt about it. But again, you know, I think I mentioned early on, as we talk about military assistance, we, the United States, have given about $119 billion by people who track this stuff. Europeans have given about $138 billion, frankly, in total. A large portion of theirs, however, has been economic, financial, and humanitarian aid. The vast majority of ours has been military aid. On the U.S. side, though, about 60 cents of every dollar in military assistance we've been providing to Ukraine actually never left the United States, because this was payment to General Dynamics, Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, et cetera, for military weaponry that went on to Ukraine. So our industries actually have profited pretty well out of this particular conflict. We need to be honest enough to say that. Furthermore, of course, it has allowed us, I think, the ability to begin an expansion of those defense industries to make sure that we can maintain support not only for Ukraine, but also we're now providing dramatic military aid to Israel, as well as make sure our wartime stocks are up to the requirements for the future.
A lot of pieces on the board. I guess we wait and see where move now, because if you'd asked me 3 months ago this is where we were going to be, I would have said no. I'm not sure what you would have said, but I thought we might have been further along to something of more positive in nature.
I think you're right, Neil. I mean, coming out of this meeting between Mr. Trump or telephone call, really not much came out of it, I think, in summary. There was no breakthrough. There was a suggestion about, as we mentioned, I think, a limited ceasefire and negotiation for a longer ceasefire. But in the end, and there was a lot of discussion about how important improved relations between Russia and the United States were. In the end, my read, frankly, is a lot of pressure is being put on the Ukrainians to make concessions. I haven't seen any real effort to get the Russians to make concessions. The only concession the Russians have offered so far is one of the senior aides by Mr. Putin said publicly, well, our concession is we won't take more Ukrainian territory. And that's a major concession by Russia, which is really kind of topsy-turvy when you think about trying to end a conflict. So Mr. Putin, I think, is reading the room, saying, right at the moment, I've got the upper hand. It looks possible that Washington may tire of this particular conflict and pull out totally. So if I can just kind of string this along and, you know, keep talking to Mr. Trump in particular about what a great benefit it would be if the United States and Russia improve relations, that's where this will all go. Furthermore, this has been incredibly useful in the last few weeks for me, as Ukraine now has become a vehicle for me to drive bigger and bigger wedges between the United States and its European allies, which ultimately I firmly believe is the major objective Mr. Putin is pursuing. I think it's notable that, though, after the call between Putin and Trump, Mr. Trump did call President Zelensky, and I'm sure discussed with him what they had talked about. I see no evidence that Mr. Trump contacted any of our European allies who are very invested in this conflict to give them any idea of how that discussion went. And the absence of that phone call, I think, speaks volumes.
Absolutely, no doubt. Thank you so much for spending all of this time with us this morning. We truly appreciate it. You certainly bring a lot of context to the drama that's going on behind the curtains, for certain.
You're very kind.
Thank you so much, and have a great weekend.
See you.
All right, that's Colonel Jeff McCausland, CBS military analyst. We will be right back, folks. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us.
Take me out to the ball game.
What are you doing?
Did you know DirecTV has the most MLB games?
So you're singing?
Yeah, they put your favorite teams front and center right when you turn it on. Buy me some cold cuts and flapjacks.
Those aren't even the words.
I'm allergic to peanuts.
Stream DirecTV, home of the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks. RSNs available with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package.
Do you believe you were wrongfully terminated for speaking up against your employer? Wilshire Law Firm isn't afraid to go up against corporate giants and will protect you every step of the way. Get justice and feel safe. Call the experts at Wilshire Law Firm at 1-800-800-3333.
Low-carb keto yo-yo diets, GLP-1 injections, but you're never going to lose weight if your liver is clogged with fat. So what can you do? It's simple. Almased. Almased is a natural superfood protein shake that uses natural amino acids and bioactive peptides to help unclog your liver and optimize your metabolism so it's easier to lose weight. And it's been scientifically proven to preserve muscle mass. Join millions who have transformed their lives with Almased. Find out more and see the university studies at almased.com. That's almased.com.
StreetEasy asked former New Yorkers if there's anything they miss about life in New York City.
Let me put it this way. House of the Home Theater sounds appealing. But that's until you realize you no longer have a theater district.
Whether you're looking to rent or it's time to buy, StreetEasy has the local expertise you need to never leave NYC. Go to StreetEasy.com to learn more. StreetEasy is an assumed name of Zillow Inc., which has licenses in all 50 states.
I'm Jordan Robinson, host of the new podcast, The Women's Hoop Show. Each episode, I'll be joined by a rotating group of women's basketball experts to talk WNBA, college hoops, the new Unrivaled League, and the shifting landscape of the sport. The game is growing, and so are we. Listen to and follow The Women's Hoop Show and Odyssey Podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.